Last week in our study, we got rid of Belshazzar, didn't we? Yeah, we wrote some stuff on the wall and got rid of him. Actually, God did it, but we'll kind of take credit for it. Yeah, he came to an end last week. And so when chapter 7 says, in the first year of Belshazzar, what the heck? I thought the Medo-Persians did us the favor of getting rid of him. But this book is not in strict chronological order. So what's going to occur next is actually given to us in reference to the same guy that we were talking about last week, Belshazzar. It's given to us in reference to his reign. Remember, I'm sure you got this chart memorized. You remember all of this. He came on the scene about right here, about 553 B.C., Belshazzar did. So when this chapter is introduced to us here, chapter 7, it says, in the first year of his reign, Daniel's going to have this dream. So we've been pulled back from here to here. So we're back in about 553 B.C. now when this dream is going to take place. So some years before the end of that empire, what looks like about 14 years or so, Daniel had this dream that we're going to see here in chapter 7. Okay? So in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, about 553 B.C., Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. Then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. So of the total six dreams or visions that we see in this book, Nebuchadnezzar had two of them. Daniel's going to have four of them. This is the first one we see from Daniel. So he has this dream, and he takes notes. It impresses him so that he writes some of it down. And he says in verse 2, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. You didn't realize there were only four winds in heaven, did you? Yeah. Yeah, the four winds of heaven. What the heck are those, I wonder? Well, the book of Revelation uses a similar expression in chapter 7 and verse 1 where it talks about angels holding back the four winds from the four corners of the earth. It's hard to figure out how it is a sphere has corners, but it's probably just a reference to the north, south, east, and west directions. And there it appears to be the sovereignty of God at work in the affairs of the nations of the world, and angels are involved in that there. This is probably something similar here. The four winds of heaven are probably a reference to the sovereignty of God controlling the affairs of men, as we'll see as we go along. And they were stirring up the great sea. Now, this one is a little, and by the way, we'll get an interpretation here in a little bit, so I'm going to guess along ahead of time, and then you can grade me later on whether or not I guessed right. So we'll get an interpretation, so don't worry about that. But I'm going to guess that the Great Sea is probably a reference to Gentile people. That's a metaphor that's used in a number of places in Scripture. The sea typically represents the Gentiles. Land is typically represents the Jewish people. So if I'm right in this so far, I'm guessing that maybe there's some sort of a divine stirring up of Gentile peoples that's embedded in Daniel's vision here so far. And four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. Normally, beasts don't live in the sea, do they? I mean, sea critters do, but animals don't usually live in the ocean. And so these beasts are different than literal beasts in that they come up from the ocean. Now, there's four of them. Have we seen anything yet in our study where the number four meant anything? Remember that vision back in chapter 2? The statue was segmented into how many pieces? Four pieces. Four pieces in chapter 2, four beasts in chapter 7. I wonder if those are related in any way. Four and four. I don't know. Let's read on and see. But it may be that the four segments in chapter 2, remember what those were? Gentile world empires. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Now we got four beasts here in chapter 7. I wonder if they could be similar. Let's see. Well, the first one of these four beasts he saw was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. Now, this first symbol is a sort of the king of beasts, along with the king of flying critters, eagle. So this one kind of combines sort of the head of both of these areas, doesn't it? A lion and an eagle. And by the way, that strangely enough was the symbol of Babylon, a winged lion, symbol of Babylon. That's kind of strange, isn't it? Remember what the head in that image we saw earlier was? The first segment was Babylon, remember?
Yeah, Babylon.
And this guy, the first beast that we see here, kind of has the same symbology associated with it. Well, I'll be dipped. I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind also was given to it. Well, does the concept of the human mind have any relationship to anything we've seen so far? Back in chapter 2, we saw, or not in chapter 2, but the symbology of Babylon in chapter 2, we later saw kind of embellished for us in chapter 4. Remember what happened to Nebuchadnezzar? Lost his mind and then got it back. So this thing, this symbol of a winged lion, had its wings plucked, and it was given a human quality to it. And behold, another beast, the second one, resembling a bear. So the second of these four critters is a bear, and it was raised up on one side. This is a lopsided bear, isn't it? Yeah, he's raised up on one side, but he's not balanced. He's not even. This looks like whatever it is, one side is bigger, stronger, better than the other side. And it had three ribs in its mouth. And they said to it, "Arise, devour much meat." Now, in our second segment in the statue, that torso segment represented the Medo-Persian Empire, didn't it? Medo-Persian Empire. The Medes and the Persians kind of teamed up to form that empire. This is sort of a summary of a variety of them. The Babylonian Empire now was kind of right in through here, modern-day Iraq and long in through there. The Medo-Persian Empire then went all the way down through here. And in that empire, which one of the two do you think was the strongest, the Medes or the Persians? Persians were, weren't they? Who are the Persians today? It's the Iranians today, isn't it? But in that empire, the Medes were kind of, they also ran, and the Persians were the strong element. So this imbalanced figure here of a bear, I think, is represented by that Medo-Persian Empire, and the Persians were by far the stronger of the two. So in our chapter 2 segment, the second segment representing the Medo-Persian Empire, looks like maybe we have the same thing here. The three ribs are probably Lydia, Egypt, and Babylon, which were the three smaller empires that the Medo-Persian Empire gobbled up. So those three ribs are probably those countries. Now after this, verse 6, we get the third one. Behold, another one like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Now, the third one of these critters is a leopard. It, too, is winged. And in our chapter 2 summary, the third one was the Greek Empire. Here's a picture of it. It extends all the way from Greece. You might think Greece would be involved with it, wouldn't you? The Greek Empire. Goes all the way over to India. Alexander the Great conquered all that territory in about 3 years. That guy was a hoss when it comes to military action, wasn't he? All of this. But this beast has four heads or four somethings or another, doesn't it? Wonder what in the world that could be. Yeah, four heads. Well, Alexander had four buds. Childhood guys that grew up with him and were the generals in his army that controlled all of that Greek empire. These four guys were Ptolemy, that's with a P on the front, Ptolemy, Cassander, Lysimachus, and Seleucus. Those four guys ran the Greek empire for Alexander. So in chapter 2, the third element was Greece, and here in chapter 7, it looks like the third element is also Greece. So far, chapter 2 and chapter 7 are tracking one another, aren't they? That's what we're guessing. Now, we haven't gotten the interpretation yet, but that's what we're guessing. All right, that's three out of the four. Verse 7 gives us the fourth, and I kept looking in the night vision, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong, and it had iron teeth. Now, in chapter 2, the bottom segment were legs of iron, weren't they? This one has iron teeth. And it is not likened into any animal that you know anything about. The others were. This one is not described as some kind of an animal that you know about. This is a monstrosity that is not well metaphored by another animal. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Well, back in chapter 2, the fourth segment had 10 toes, didn't it? Remember that? Clay trying to mix with iron, and that doesn't mix well. Here, it's represented by some kind of a beast, not really likened unto any animal we know, but it has 10 horns in this particular case. Horns are oftentimes used to represent kingdoms, empires, states. So I'm going to guess now that this, whatever he's talking about here, this beast has some sort of a 10-state, 10-federation of nations united together in some way. That's what I'm going to guess. Okay? That's what I think the 10 horns probably are. But we'll see. So while I was contemplating the 10 horns, behold, another horn. A little one came up among them. Well, here's number 11. You got these 10 horns. They're present. And another horn comes up from amongst this group of horns, an 11th one. And three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. Wow. This 11th horn on this beast rips up three others in the process of rising to prominence among them. So whatever this group of 10 is, these 10 horns, this guy rips out three of them. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. Clearly, this horn is symbolizing some sort of human, because he's now described as having these human traits of eyes and a mouth. And the prominent ones are the eyes and the mouth. So whoever this new player is among the 10. Now, in chapter 2, all we saw were 10 toes. We didn't see an 11th toe come up and stomp on all the others or anything. So we didn't have this detail in chapter 2. We didn't see this 11th guy rise up and rip out three of his peers in the process, these other horns. We get that here. So this is new information in chapter 7. So we got the picture so far? Four beasts rise up out of the sea, and they have these various qualities that he's described here. The fourth one is unusual and different from the previous three because it has 10 horns, probably some form of government entities, and an 11th one rises up and destroys or uproots three of them in the process. And he's given this last horn, this 11th one, is given human characteristics, especially that of a mouth. Eyes and a mouth. Okay, I kept looking, and the thrones were set up. And the Ancient of Days took his seat. Who do you think that is? Who's the Ancient of Days? Well, that's usually a reference to God. So he keeps looking, and a scene of judgment now develops. They set up thrones. And the judge takes a seat on the thrones. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were a burning fire. These are all symbols of judgment, aren't they? And if you want a challenge in interpreting Scripture, go read Ezekiel chapter 1 and figure out what's being described there, a picture to us, and then, you know, draw a picture of it or whatever. If you can figure out what that wheel in a wheel is and all that other stuff, it's like a gyroscope or something. That's God's portable throne, by the way. Ezekiel chapter 1, you see God's mobile throne, the one he drives around in. He rides to different places in that mobile throne in Ezekiel chapter 1. But this scene looks like it's a permanent one, probably in heaven. It is a scene of judgment, and all these symbols around his throne is that of judgment. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him, and thousands upon thousands were attending him. And myriads upon myriads were standing before him, and the court sat, and the books were opened. What books? The books of works were opened. There are books in heaven, apparently, that contain the works of men, and they will be opened. Revelation chapter 20, verse 12 talks about them. They will be opened to show men that from those works that they have done, none of them are sufficient to gain them acceptance before God. The books are proof against them. And in this scene of judgment, those works are brought forth and are used in judgment, it appears. Then I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. This guy is bragging and blowing about all of the great things that he has done or will do. And I kept looking until the beast was slain, and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. Wow. Things don't work out too good for this fourth beast here, do they? While this guy is bragging and blowing about how great and wonderful he is, whoever, whatever he is, he's destroyed. And he's thrown into some kind of a fire, perhaps a lake of fire, maybe, something like that. So whatever successes he has for a period of time, they're brought to an end by the Ancient of Days. And he's end up in the lake of fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. It looked like these guys all dissolved away, but they actually sort of come back to life here. They're given an extension of time. And so what looked like was dead and gone comes back to life. Kind of got this vision in mind. You're getting a feel for now what's going on here. Stop me if you want to go over anything any further. So he kept looking into night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. Oh, a son of man? I wonder who that is. Who uses that title anywhere that we know anything about? The Son of God uses it, doesn't he? The Son of Man. This is one of his favorite identifiers of himself, and it ties him to mankind. Son of God usually ties him to God. Son of Man ties him to us, mankind. So here comes the Son of Man. He came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. So here comes this additional participant here up to this scene of judgment to the Ancient of Days there and was presented to him. I'm reminded from this vision of this scene we have in Revelation chapter 5. I saw on the right hand of him who sat on the throne a book written inside on the back and sealed up with seven seals, and I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the book and break its seals?" And no one in heaven or on the earth or under the earth was able to open the book or to even look into it. And I began to weep greatly because no one was found worthy to open the book or to look into it. And one of the elders said to me, "Stop weeping. Behold, the Lion that is from the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has overcome so as to open the book and its seven seals." And so he comes and takes the book out of God's hands. And so the presentation of the Son of Man in the scene of judgment to God the Father, it looks like the same similar thing to what we see there in Revelation chapter 5. And to him, that is the Son of Man, was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, and all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting one, which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. As for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me, and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. I approached one of those who were standing by and began asking him the exact meaning of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. And that's what follows. So Daniel is going to get one of the participants in this heavenly scene to explain to him what all of this stuff means. Now, he can interpret dreams, as we've seen before. God has equipped him to be able to do that, but he can't understand all of this one yet. He's got to get some divine help in understanding this vision, and he's going to get it, and that's what we'll follow in verse 17 through the rest of the chapter. All right, before we look at the interpretation, and you can grade me on my guesses, you have any questions or anything about the vision? You see what he has seen. Four beasts coming up out of the sea. The fourth one is of particular interest because it has 10 horns, 10 symbols of kingdoms or governmental entities. An 11th one comes up and roots up 3 of those and starts bragging and carrying on about how great and wonderful he is. And he's crushed. And the Son of Man comes on the scene and sets up an everlasting kingdom that never goes away. That's kind of the scene, okay? Any questions about the scene? Yeah, Jane?
Well, don't you think that it might be that little horn might be the Antichrist?
Well, let's let the interpretation tell us who that is, right? Fortunately, we have an interpretation here. So we don't even have to take a good guess. We're going to be told what all this is. All right, let's look at that first. Verse 17 and following now gives us the interpretation. These great beasts, which are 4 in number, are 4 kings who will rise from the earth. Well, we got pretty close on that one, didn't we? We thought these were probably some kind of empires. We thought they were the Babylonian, the Medo-Persian, the Greek, and the Roman empires. And so we're pretty close there, 4 kings. They arise from the earth. But the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. God's people will ultimately take over and rule and reign all of these kingdoms here. So these guys rise up for a period of time. This is the Roman Empire, by the way. We'll leave it up here for a minute. These Gentile kings rise up for a period of time, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, but ultimately God's people take over and rule. So then I desire to know the meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful with its teeth of iron and its claws of bronze, which devoured, crushed, trampled down the remainder with its feet, and the meaning of those 10 horns which are on its head, and the other horn which came up from which 3 of them fell, namely, that horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts and which was larger in appearance than its associates. So he particularly now questions his revealer here about this fourth one, this fourth beast. with the ten horns and all that stuff. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them. Yikes. This 11th horn actually wars with the saints of God, the believers of this world. He attacks and goes after them, and he was overpowering them. He was successful in defeating God's children. Until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the highest one, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. So there's a period of time in which this 11th horn will be successful in persecuting and harming and killing God's people, but the time of judgment will come, and when it does, they become victorious and they take possession of the kingdom. So Daniel is saying to this angelic aid here, what's that? What's this guy about? What's this mean? And so he says, verse 23, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms, and it will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. As for the ten horns, out of this kingdom, ten kings will arise. So out of this old Roman Empire that you see here, outlined in red, ten kingdoms will arise and be joined together, unite together in some capacity and in some way. Doesn't mean that every country represented within the boundaries there will be a participant. There's more countries than ten and so on. But from this general geographic region will come this ten-nation federation of some sort, whatever the glue that holds it together is. We're not sure. It could be political, it could be military, it could be financial, I don't know. But it will grow up. And the ten horns will come from that kingdom. They'll arise, and another will arise after them, and he'll be different from the previous ones and will subdue three kings. So from whatever form this ten-nation federation takes, coming out of this old Roman Empire, one more guy is going to rise up out of that group, uprooting three others in the process, and he will become the big dog of the whole bunch. He'll speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One. He will actually attack God's people, which will consist mostly of Jews and some Gentile believers who are still alive at that time, or they will be saved during the tribulation period. But his object of attack here is them, God's people. And he will be successful for a while, and he'll tend to make alterations in times and in law, and they'll be given to him into his hand for a time, times, and half a time, three and a half somethings. This guy will actually try to change basic fundamental laws of nature and laws of business and laws of government and that sort of thing. He'll try to, in essence, run the world himself. And he will be successful at doing that for three and a half somethings. It's probably years. That's what we think, anyway. For time, times, that's one and two and a half. So one plus two and a half is three and a half. So it looks like it's a reference here to 3.5 years. This guy will be very successful at attacking God's people. As we get this layered together, I'll give you a full summary of this as we go along, but we'll kind of take it as we get it here for the time being. So then the court will sit for judgment, and its dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. Ultimately, this entity that we're talking about here, this ten-nation entity, ran by one guy who rises to the top and destroying three others in the process, ultimately that entity will be destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the Highest One. Ultimately, God's people are victorious. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all the dominion will serve and obey him. And at this point, Daniel just about had all he could take. My thoughts were greatly alarming, and my face grew pale, but I kept the matter to myself. So all of this just really shakes Daniel up. It upsets him. It's so striking and so devastating that he has a hard time processing it. So let's go back and review now what we've seen in this and the vision in chapter 2. The vision in chapter 2 is a little coarser than this one, but it consists of the same basic information. Four different Gentile world empires will dominate the Jewish people from the time of Daniel on down to Messiah. The fourth one of those is the most interesting because it is one that looks like it dies and goes away, but it comes back. It gets reorganized and reformed during the tribulation period, during this 7-year period right here. And from this group, one guy dominates all of the others, kind of wiping three of them out in the process. All right? He is a particular, we're going to see a lot more about him before we're done here in the book of Daniel. He is of particular interest. He is probably the most noteworthy human being other than the God-man, Jesus. He's probably the most noteworthy human being we know anything about anywhere. All right, that was chapter 2. Now, when we went through chapter 7, we saw similar stuff. We saw the same four Gentile world empires described in this case as animals, not segments of a statue. But again, the fourth one is the most interesting because it's where we see these 10 different kings within that old Roman Empire formed into some sort of conglomeration, and the rise of one of those over the other three. And we're going to see a little bit more in chapter 8 of the same basic thing, but we're not quite to chapter 8 yet. Any questions about anything we've seen so far in either one of these two visions? They are essentially the same information. Chapter 7 embellishes chapter 2 a little bit, gives us a little more info. We didn't know about the 10 kingdoms in chapter 2. We knew there were 10 toes, but we didn't know exactly what they were. But here we're told they're kings. And one of these from that group, another one, an 11th guy, rises and becomes a player. And we're going to learn a lot more about him as we go on. Any questions about what we've seen so far? Now, some people don't care a lot about this because most of this eschatology is either history to us or it will take place after we're gone. So they don't care. But we probably ought to care since God gave it to us. But all of this is past, and this will take place without us because we're out of here before that takes place. We're out of there right there. But we'll try to learn it anyway, and you can decide whether you want to pay any attention to it or not. All right. Let's go on to chapter 8. We'll at least get started on it. May get finished on it. I don't know. Okay. In the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, this is 2 years later. If the first vision was in 553 B.C., this is 551 B.C., 2 years later. So in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, the king, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, subsequent to the one which appeared to me previously. That is the one we just looked at in chapter 7. So here's another vision. Three out of the six in the book, Daniel's second. I looked in a vision, and it came about while I was looking that I was in the city of Susa, which is in the province of Elam. And I looked in the vision, and myself was beside the Ulai Canal. So he's kind of setting the scene for us physically where he is. He's over there in what is today like Iraq. And I lifted my gaze and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns was standing in the front of the canal. Okay, in this vision now, our first player is a ram. Two-horned ram. And the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. Now, in our previous vision, we saw this bear that was lopsided, and we concluded that's the Medo-Persian Empire because of the dominance of the Persians over the Medes. Here, this ram has two horns, but one of them was bigger than the other one. And throughout our visions now, the horns typically represent kingdoms. So is it possible that in this case, the two-horned ram, one being bigger than the other one, could be the same basic thing as the lopsided bear, that is the Medo-Persian Empire? Makes sense to me. Let's look at it. We'll get the interpretation later and see. And I saw the ram budding westward, northward, and southward, and no other beast was be able to stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power, but he did as he pleased and magnified himself. If that is indeed the Medo-Persian Empire, then what he's simply referring to there is the fact that they were successful in running over everybody. And they were. So that makes good sense. Now, let's see, that's the Greeks. We'll look at them in a minute and get the Medo-Persians back up here. So these guys were successful in dominating all of this region here and through here. Everything inside the red border there. So while he's watching something that looks like this empire growing into place, verse 5, while I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west. Now, while he's watching this animal, representing, I think, this empire coming into play, he sees another animal come on the scene, and it coming from the west. It's coming from over here. What's over here on the west? Right here. Greece. The west of this empire is Greece. So while he's watching an animal that looks like it's representative of the Medo-Persian Empire, he sees a male goat coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without even touching the ground. This thing is flying. And it had a conspicuous horn between its eyes. And it came up to the ram that had the two horns, which I'd seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. And I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him. He struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground, trampled on him, and there was none other to rescue the ram from his power. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly. So what just was described there? Something just ran over that empire. And he did it in very short order. This thing is described as just flying across the surface of the earth. And of course, if we're right in our interpretations, that would be Alexander and his empire. You can almost overlay that one over the Medo-Persian Empire because he took over the whole place. And he came from the west, Greece, and ran all the way over to India there. And he magnified himself exceedingly. Alexander died at the age of 33. He did all of this in about 3 years. The guy was good at what he did. And that's conquer people. He came from good stock. You remember who his father was? Philip. Remember Philip of Macedon? The city named after him, it was Philippi. Yeah, his dad was quite a military leader as well in Macedonia. So Alexander came from good military stock, and he was outstanding as a military leader. But as soon as he was mighty, the large horn, that's him, was broken, and in its place came four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. So when Alexander gets, when he dies off, they think he might have had malaria and a few other things, and kind of exacerbated by undisciplined living. He died at the ripe old age of 33. And his empire was given, broken down, given to these four generals, these four childhood friends of his that grew up with him and were running his army. That's probably the four winds of, or the four conspicuous horns of verse 8. Okay, got the picture so far now? The first animal was doing good until the second animal came along and stomped it. He fell apart into four pieces. And out of one of them came forth a rather small horn. Now, don't confuse this horn in 8:9 with the horn in 7:8. The horn in 7:8 comes up out of the 10-nation federation of the revived Roman Empire. This guy comes from one of Alexander's four generals' line of descent. Different individuals. This guy, however, as we will see as we go forward, in 8:9, this little horn here that came from one of Alexander's four generals, he will be typical of and representative of the horn that we saw back in 7:8. We'll develop all that as we get going a little further in this. But it ain't exactly the same guy. It's a guy a lot like him. I'll show you that as we go. So out of one of them came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south and toward the east and toward the beautiful land. That is, he was ruling over territories close to Israel, as we'll see. And it grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the hosts and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. Usually the host of heaven is referring to God's people, Israeli leaders. So this guy, it looks like, is going to defeat and trample a bunch of Israeli leaders during his reign and during his day. It even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host. That's God. This guy thinks he's God. Now, the horn we saw earlier coming from the 10-nation federation, he's going to talk like he thinks he's God too. But they're different guys. This guy is going to typify for us that 10-nation federation guy that we'll see later. So he thinks he's God. And he removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. This guy actually stopped the Jewish worship in the sanctuary and sort of trampled it down in the process. And on account of transgressions, a host will be given over to the horn along with his regular sacrifice, and will fling truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. This guy will distort Jewish worship. He will promote lies and will be successful and prosperous in doing this. Then I heard the Holy One speaking, and another Holy One said to that particular one who was speaking, "How long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply while the transgression causes horror so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled?" How long is this going to go on that this guy is successful in opposing God's people and destroying the sanctuary of worship and so on? And he said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored." 2,300 evenings and mornings is 6.38 years. Not 7, not 3.5, 6.38 years. So the duration of this guy's terror reign is not the same as the guy in 7:8. Different guys running for different periods of time. All right? All right, the interpretation, verse 15 and following. What does this vision have to say? "So it came about when I, Daniel, had seen a vision that I sought to understand, and behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man, and heard a voice of the man between the banks of the Euli, and he called out and said, 'Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision.'" Who's Gabriel? He's an angel, isn't he? How many named angels do we know of?
Two.
Two? Name them.
Michael.
Michael? Gabriel? How about Satan? Actually, three, isn't there? We know three names. Two of them good, one of them bad. Gabriel's one of the named angels in Scripture, and he's nearly always associated with revealing something to the nation Israel from God. So he came near while I was standing, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. And he said to me, "Son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end." Time of the end. Israel's end, eschatologically speaking, is near the second advent. So this vision has to do with the time frame. We'll look at it here in a minute. Right down toward the second advent. And while he was talking with me, I sank into a deep sleep and with my face to the ground, but he touched me and made me stand upright. And he said, "Behold, I'm going to let you know what will occur in the final period of the indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end." That will be the tribulation period. This vision has to do with the very end, like we've seen before. The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. All right, we guessed that one right again, didn't we? Medo-Persia was the ram with the two horns, one which was big and one was small. The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. Oh, we got that one right too. And the large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. That's Alexander the Great. And the horn was broken that arose in its place represent four kingdoms which will arise from this nation, though not with his power. That's the four generals of Alexander's empire. And in the latter period of their rule, when the transgressors have ran their course, a king will arise, insolent and skilled in intrigue. That is, during the descendancy of these four generals, some guy is going to arise, one of their descendants is going to arise, and he will be skilled in intrigue, and he will be insolent. His power will be mighty, but not by his own power. He'll destroy with an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people. And through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit to succeed by influence. And he'll magnify himself in his heart, and he'll destroy many while they are at ease. He will even oppose the prince of princes, but he will be broken without human agency. Who in the world is he talking about that will do all of this stuff? This sounds a lot like the horn we saw back in 7-8, doesn't it? But it's not. This guy comes from the line of descent of Alexander's generals. You ever hear of a guy named Antiochus Epiphanes? Ever hear that name? One of Alexander's generals was a guy named Seleucus. And he took over the area of Syria, and that particular part of the empire. And one of his descendants decided that he wanted to be not only the ruler of the Syrian region, but he wanted to rule Egypt as well. Okay? He was ruling up in this area here, but he also wanted to rule down here in Egypt. The guy that took over this area was Ptolemy. These guys, all of these descendants down here are Ptolemites. This guy was up here. So he wants to take over this area here. Well, who's right between them? Israel. So you might suspect that as he and these guys battle it out, Israel's going to get trampled on in the process. Do you have, you know what the Apocrypha is? Ever heard that term, the Apocrypha? The Apocrypha is a collection of 15 different books or parts of books that the Protestant churches do not think are inspired. They're not included in your Protestant Bible. The Catholics do. They include the Apocrypha in their Catholic Bible. Some of them are just fanciful. You couldn't make up a story like some of them. They're not inspired. But in some of them, there is some history that is of some relationship to what's going on here. In the first book of Maccabees, two of the books in the 15 apocryphal books are 1st and 2nd Maccabees. It's the story of the Maccabee revolution against this guy, and I'll tell you why here in just a moment. I'm going to read to you from the first book of Maccabees, first chapter or so here, a little bit. And it's going to describe this guy that we just were referenced here in the book of Daniel. Check this out. Alexander of Macedon, the son of Philip, this is Alexander the Great, marched from the land of Kittim, defeated Darius, the king of Persia and Media, and seized his throne, being already the king of Greece. In the course of many campaigns, he captured fortified towns, slaughtered kings, traversed the earth to its remotest bounds, and plundered innumerable nations. When at last the world lay quiet under his rule, his pride knew no limits. He built up an extremely powerful army, and he ruled over countries, nations, dominions, and all of them paid him tribute. The time came when he fell ill, and not knowing that he was dying, he summoned his generals, nobles who had been brought up with him from childhood, and divided his empire among them while he was still alive. Alexander had reigned 12 years when he died. His generals took over the government, each in his own province. On the day of his death, they were all crowned as kings, and their descendants exceeded them for many years, and they brought untold miseries upon the world. A scion of this stock, that wicked man, Antiochus Epiphanes, son of King Antiochus. This would be a Seleucid descendant, a descendant of one of Alexander's four generals. He'd been a hostage in Rome before he succeeded to the throne in the year 137 in the Greek era. That's 175 BC. So this guy, Antiochus Epiphanes, came to power in Syria in 175 BC. He is a descendant of one of Alexander's four generals. Got the picture so far? At the time there appeared in the land of Israel a group of renegade Jews who incited the people, said, "Let us enter into a covenant with the Gentiles around about." And they said, "Because disaster upon disaster has overtaken us since we segregated ourselves from them." This group wanted to join with these Gentile leaders like Antiochus because they were getting stomped on all the time. So they wanted to side with this guy, this king of Syria, in 175 B.C., the people thought this a good argument, and some of them in their enthusiasm went to the king and received authority to introduce non-Jewish laws and customs. They built a sports stadium in the Gentile style in Jerusalem. They removed their marks of circumcision and repudiated the Holy Covenant. They entered Mary with the Gentiles and abandoned themselves to evil ways. So Israel compromised with this guy for their own safety and protection rather than trusting God. Got the picture so far? When he was firmly established on his throne, Antiochus made up his mind to become a king of Egypt as so as to rule over both kingdoms. He assembled a powerful force of chariots, elephants, and cavalry in a great fleet and invaded Egypt. When the battle was joined, Ptolemy, king of Egypt, this was one of the other four generals in his line of descent, was seized with panic and he took flight, leaving many dead. The fortified towns were captured and the land pillaged. Now I'm still reading out of 1 Maccabees. On his return from the conquest of Egypt in the year 143, and this would be 169 B.C., Antiochus marched with a strong force against Israel and Jerusalem. In his arrogance, he entered the temple and carried off the golden altar, the lampstand with its equipment, the table for the bread of the presence. In other words, all the stuff in the sanctuary, in the temple there, he carried off. The cups, bowls, golden censers, and all that stuff. He stripped off the gold plating from the temple front, seized the silver, gold, and precious vessels, and whatever secret treasures he found, he took them all with him, and he left for his own country. He had caused much bloodshed and gloated over all that he had done. 2 years later, the king sent to the towns of Judea a high revenue official who arrived at Jerusalem with a powerful force. His language was friendly but full of guile, for once he had gained the city's confidence, he suddenly attacked it. He dealt it a heavy blow and killed many Israelites, plundering the city and setting it ablaze. He pulled down houses and walls on every side. Women and children were made prisoners and the cattle seized. I'm skipping over some of this, jumping down to verse 41 here. Then the king issued a decree throughout his empire. His subjects were all to become one people and abandon their own laws and religion. This is Antiochus' decree now. The nations were everywhere complied with the royal command, and many in Israel accepted the foreign worship, sacrificing to idols, profaning the Sabbath. Moreover, the king sent agents with written orders to Jerusalem and the towns of Judea. Ways and customs foreign to the country were to be introduced. Burnt offerings, sacrifices, and libations in the temple were forbidden. Sabbath and feast days were to be profaned. The temple and its ministers to be defiled. Altars, idols, and sacred precincts were to be established. Swine and other unclean beasts to be offered in sacrifice. They must leave their sons uncircumcised. They must make themselves in every way abominable, unclean, and profane, and so forget the law and change all their statutes. The penalty for this was death. So that's what Antiochus did to the Jews in 169 B.C. He basically took over the place, destroyed temple worship, set up sacrificing pigs and all this other kind of stuff, and was basically an abomination to God and them. The Maccabean Revolution was the attack against him by Judas Maccabeus and his family. And that's what this book is all about. And you can read the rest of it if you want to. The point of all of this is that this guy, Antiochus Epiphanes, prefigures for us, foreshadows for us, the little horn in chapter 7. The Antichrist. The one that rises up in that 10-nation federation, destroying the other three in the process. He is foreshadowed in history for us by this historical guy, Antiochus Epiphanes, a Syrian king who reigned from 175 to 168 B.C. So we get this picture of the Antichrist in this guy. His behavior is exactly like what the Antichrist will be. So we have this foreshadowing, and that's what this vision that Daniel just had here in chapter 8 is all about. This vision in chapter 8 embellishes what we've seen in 2 and 7 with an example of this final guy here, the Antichrist. So here we don't know much about him. We just know there's 10 toes. Here we know that he will rise up amongst this 10-nation federation, speaking great and wonderful things and all that stuff about himself. Here we learn in this one that he is foreshadowed for us by this historical figure of Antiochus Epiphanes, a Syrian king who behaved just like him 169 years before Christ. So, do you see the flow of the three visions now, chapters 2, 7, and 8? It's the same story. It just gets a little more specific, a little more embellished as we go through the three different visions. Ultimately, we get this historical guy, Antiochus Epiphanes, illustrating for us this guy who is yet to come. So we know what he's going to be like. We can go look at his life and see what he was like. That's what this guy is going to be like. All right. I got you on overtime now, so I got to stop. Any questions or comments about anything we've seen so far? We'll take more time next week if we want to talk about this more.